Welcome to the second season of the Advanced Practice Perspectives. I'm Tricia Williams.
And I'm Toby O'Brien. This is a podcast created by advanced practice providers for advanced practice providers. Our goal is to provide you with education and inspiration. We will be chatting with pediatric experts on timely key topics and giving you an inside look at the various advanced practice role at Children's Mercy.
We are so glad that you're joining us today. So sit back, tune in, and let's get started. Today, we are pleased to have Rebecca Kaler. Rebecca is a family nurse practitioner in the hematology and oncology department at Children's Mercy Hospital. Rebecca, we are so happy to have you with us today. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been around a long time, so I'll try to summarize it as best as possible. I became a nurse in 1977. Some people aren't even born in 1977, and I'm working with them here in the clinic. And I always told myself that I was going to be a nurse, and I started out with finances limited, so I became a licensed practical nurse. Soon after I became a licensed practical nurse, I realized I wanted to go further. Again, due to finances, I jumped in to be an associate degree registered nurse. Practiced as a registered nurse associate degree for many years. Went back to school, got my bachelor's degree. After I received my bachelor's degree, I wanted to grow further and become an educator for other nurses, and decided to get my master's degree. My master's degree was in Wichita, Kansas, and I lived in Hays, Kansas. That's 186 miles apart. I had to be in Wichita 2 days a week. They didn't do anything over the internet back then. You had to do in-classroom work. So I graduated with my master's in 1993, began teaching academic BSN nurses at Wichita State University, continued to work clinicals on the side. I love trauma and I love critical care. So I worked at Wesley Hospital night shift and I taught nurses during the day. And I had a great time doing the combo together, not losing my clinical skills. During my 2 years working for Wichita State University, educating us in the pediatric realm, I decided, well, I think I like clinical side better, so I decided to go back to school and become an advanced practice nurse. The focus they offered at the time at Wichita State was family, so I jumped in and graduated with my family nurse practitioner and took my national certification exam and started practicing in 1997. I've been working from 97 to the current date as an advanced practice nurse in several different specialties, anywhere from primary care to SICU to trauma in the ED to education. And in the last 22 years, I've been focusing on working with hematology, oncology, adult, and pediatric patients, and since 2017 was assigned to develop a role for the pediatric stroke program here at Children's Mercy. So currently, I have been working at Children's Mercy since 2012, hematology, oncology, and in 2017 started including pediatric stroke as one of my specialties too. That brings you up to date.
Wow, Rebecca, you really do have a ton of experience. I remember chatting with you a few weeks ago, kind of getting to know you better, getting your kind of bio. And I mean, it goes back pretty far. So we are so thrilled to have your expertise on the podcast with us today. And we're going to dive into your experience with pediatric strokes, specifically for this podcast. I'm hoping that you can give us a rundown on pediatric strokes. I'm just curious about the incidents, causes, maybe even a little bit about presentation and prolonged sequelae of pediatric stroke patients.
I'd love to. It's become a love. I was introduced into pediatric stroke when I was in clinic seeing children in follow-up, and one of the patients that I was assigned to go in to see was a 12-month-old baby, and the baby was on Lovenox, and when I walked in, that's what I expected to be managing as the anticoagulation that the child was taking. However, I was greeted by two parents full of anxiety, and they were asking me all kinds of questions because their child sustained a stroke. And those questions I was unable to answer. So I left the room promptly and went to my collaborating physician and said, this is what I walked into. This is not what I expected. What are they talking about, a pediatric stroke and their child having a stroke 12 hours after birth? And Dr. Sharma is my collaborating physician. She goes, that's correct. And I said, oh my gosh, I have to do some digging and investigation to be able to educate these parents on what's next, first starting by educating myself. So pediatric stroke includes two age limits. The first age limit is a perinatal stroke. It occurs 28 weeks of gestation in utero to 28 days post-delivery. That's called a perinatal stroke. That occurrence is one in 4,000 births. Second type of stroke is a child stroke or children's stroke, and that is from day 30 of life to age 18. And that's considered the pediatric realm of the scope definitions. Children have strokes outside of the perinatal age, which I just gave you, is 13 per 100,000 in the Western world. That doesn't seem like a large amount. However, pediatric stroke is in the top 10 diagnoses as cause of death in children. So it's pretty significant. And the children that present and have a stroke, within the first year, they have a 50 to 80% chance of having a second stroke. So that's kind of why it's so significant to provide that education to my peers, which also lacked education, and other providers within the city and the other centers across the United States. Review of literature showed that there are a lot of facilities that they don't even acknowledge that a child's had a stroke. Instead, they say they've had a cerebral infarct or they've had hemorrhaging, cerebral hemorrhage, but they don't come back and define the actual stroke, where the stroke has occurred, and the leftover residual effects of having a stroke. That's how I got into it. And in my research, I found that there was so much literature to read and evaluate and concentrate on and put into practice on how I was going to proceed that we actually started looking at our own patients, how we identified them at Children's Mercy. So if you start at home, then you can develop out what other places are doing. What we found, the need for a pediatric stroke program is because these children were coming in, they were having delayed diagnosis anywhere from 6 hours up to 3 weeks later. They were not being addressed. They were not followed up by all the specialties to make these children grow and develop to the best of their potential. So they were showing up months, even years after their stroke to specialty clinics for interventions and symptoms that were not addressed or that all of a sudden parents have noticed, and therefore now they're referred to a specialist. So what causes a delay in identification of a stroke? Well, children present differently. And there's actually mimickers of other disease processes that go on that children also present with. So you have to ferret all this information out when they show up. But many times they'll present, first of all, with a headache. A headache can be caused from migraines, dehydration, another viral infection, a temperature. So you can actually say, okay, they have a headache. What's it related to? And not even think stroke. They can have an onset of a seizure. Brand new seizure, and then you think epilepsy, correct? So you don't even think about going down that they've had a stroke that could have potentially caused the seizure. They could have ataxia onset. Many of parents will think that is just because they're tired, their muscles are weak, or they don't have the strength that they need, so they start stretching their little legs, their arms, and then they find out they just keep falling over and they can't sit up, they can't stand up, and they start vomiting. Then vomiting, nausea, disorientation, and also they start saying words that are not clear if their speech was previously cleared. So all of these things, they're coming to you with symptoms in the ED is usually where they present, or the primary care doctor's office also. And so the first thing you're going to think of, well, headache, they could have a migraine, infection. Seizures, they can have a convulsive disorder, epilepsy. Ataxia can be just from dehydration or how they want to walk or how they're playing or growth and development stage at that time. So we have to put all these things in account and then start going down deeper as by ruling out that they don't have any of those other symptoms that are associated with those diagnoses or been diagnosed with those diagnoses before. One thing that does help is if you have an acute onset of hemiparesis that the child or aphasia or loss of vision or loss of balance, then we start thinking, oh my gosh, maybe this is a stroke and we need to look further. So those key symptoms are what we look for. We have to take it back to underlying conditions too that can cause a child to have a stroke, such as heart disease, cardioembolic strokes after infants and children have corrective heart surgery are at the highest risk of having a stroke. In addition to that, sickle cell disease, viral infections, otitis media, sinus infection can cause children to have strokes. And also if they have any head or neck trauma can cause a child to have like shaken baby syndrome, or they fall out of their crib, or an 8-month-old who's pulling themselves up at a coffee table and is trying to take those first pull-up steps and falls over and bumps their head, even if it's on the carpet, that can cause a stroke. Now, why that these symptoms or situations cause a child to be at risk for a stroke is because the arterial venous system in the child's brain is immature and the vessels and arteries are narrow. They're still growing and developing. So therefore, any little trauma, bump, infection can cause an inflammatory response, which narrows the arteries and the veins more. Then, with lack of blood flow, develops a clot, or they can have a hemorrhage from an injury, causing the child to have a stroke. So we have to take all these things in account. So those providers seeing those kids for the first time are actually walking through this process to see how to rule out and take the best choice possible. So that's with that background that I just shared with you on pediatric stroke and neonatal stroke that I built off of and found out that we in our Children's Mercy Hospital system, now you can see why these children, when they got diagnosed, if they had hemiparesia, they may go to rehab. But then when they get to rehab, the parents might say, you know, they don't eat from a spoon yet, or they're having trouble holding on to a spoon or holding on to their bottle or rolling to that side, then rehab will say, okay, we need to get that evaluated. So then they go to physical PTOT, and there they do swallow tests. And then it's like the parents will say, well, what caused this to happen? Well, let's go back and identify, did anything happen when they were an infant? Did you notice any special things? Parents will normally report, yeah, before they were 12 months old, they always used their right hand. They never used their left hand. Hand dominance does not occur until closer to the age of 2. Parents will say they had trouble sitting up. We have to prop them up. And only around 12 months were they able to sit up by themselves. When they start to take that first step, the foot turns in or the leg collapses or the weakness is so severe, they're not able to bear their weight on that one side. So things like this parents will bring up and then they're referred out to all these specialty departments. And then you find out, oh my gosh, we traced it back. This child had a stroke at approximately this age and we order an MRI and find it and find the cause. So based on our information, I'm going to go back to this. When I told you I reviewed where we were at Children's Mercy and why all of a sudden hematology was seeing children that have had strokes from a previous injury or diagnosis, and now we are 9 months to 2 years out and they're showing up in our department because they developed another clot somewhere in their body and now they're on anticoagulation and that's why they're ending up in my department. Remember that children can have a clot or a venous thrombus clot or another stroke, especially in the first year, 50% of the time after their initial stroke. So they're showing up in our clinic for us to manage their anticoagulation therapy because they need blood flow to the brain. And we're going to give them that blood flow by thinning their blood down so we can get rid of and give them best perfusion. So looking at all that data, finding out that 78% of the time our children were not routed into the specialty clinics that they needed to be in, and we can do onset of therapies at a much earlier age because of the neuroplasticity of the brain. Because remember, I told you it was very immature. Things are still developing. The quicker we do therapies and get them plugged into the right specialty clinics, the neuroplasticity, they can actually form neurons around the area that has been damaged. And that area then will be redeveloped, and the child learns how to adapt with the limitations and can overcome them, many of them, especially being able to walk normally and use both hands and not look like they've had a stroke, as you typically see in the adult population. How long does neuroplasticity last? Rehab physicians say we have it in our entire life, so even adults have the ability to, but our neurons are set somewhere between the ages of 7 and 11. Pediatric patients, they can continue to adapt and form those neurons and those receptors around that area that's been injured and function beautifully and grow beautifully in the world without anybody even knowing they've had a previous stroke. So taking that information, bringing it together, developing an impact, first of all, identifying with the emergency room what we need to know, identify the key questions to ask families when children present with symptoms that were described earlier, and that is, when was the onset? Is this out of the norm? Have they ever had the symptom before? In addition to that, do they have trouble walking, talking, weakness, headache, or vomiting since the incident or the change? And if the answer is yes to all of that, that is a kickoff for potential stroke and high suspicion. So we developed a power plan that we use that immediately notifies all the key players. The key players are ED, radiology, interventional radiologists, which we work collaboratively with KU. If we see a clot on the MRI, then the clot is retrievable. We'll send them to KU. They'll retrieve the thrombectomy and return the child within 12 to 24 hours after the procedure. We made that arrangement. And we call neurology, and neurology does the pediatric stroke assessment. All of us can use the pediatric stroke assessment also, but it's only been tested for reliability in neurologists. So the NIH pediatric stroke scale is a tool that we all can use, but the final score, if it's greater than 6 out of 42, then evident that the child's had a stroke. And so therefore, we start the process of doing an MRI. Another thing we arranged too when developing this power plan is we were able to work with the radiologist here that we have two MRI machines here. Before this power plan, let me give you a little history. I'll go back a little bit, give you a little history. There were not radiologists on staff 24/7, 7 days a week. And that includes holidays here at Children's Mercy. They worked until, I think, midnight, and then they were on call to call back. Well, becoming a pediatric stroke site, we had to make some changes. We worked with the radiologist, neurologist department, and now we have both of those specialties 24/7, 7 days a week, and including holidays. So let's say a child comes into our ED. Yes, we're suspicious of stroke. We've initiated the stroke power plan or protocol for stroke suspicion. If we have both of our MRI machines that are, we will actually pull a non-critical child out of the middle of their scan and put our child in that we are suspicious, thinking and most likely has had a stroke, and scan. We can do a specialized scan that only lasts 13 minutes. And we can see the images, and the images go over the cloud to the neurointensivist at University of Kansas Medical Center, and then our neurologist, radiologist, and interventionist at KU review the scans, and if there's a clot present, then we also have an EMS system that is here. One unit is always available to transfer our child, our patient, quickly to KU, and KU takes the child in immediately, and we remove the clot. let's just say that's one piece of all the processes that had to come into play, because the goal is to have an MRI within 30 to 60 minutes from the child hitting our doorstep and us acknowledging that we have a potential stroke patient.
That is fascinating.
And then where the nurses come into play, there's a whole bunch of interventions that you need to, as nurses, there's lab draws, there's taking glucose, there's blood pressure, there's keeping the head flat. We got the pediatric stroke power plan in place. Once you activate it, it walks you right down what steps need to be taken, who needs to be notified, and then the child is transferred to PICU as quick as possible, and continued care goes from there.
What are some things that we can look at in regards to prolonged sequelae with pediatric patients? Like, are we dealing with, you know, dysphagia, gait abnormalities with their walking, certain things like that that are prolonged over time?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. Yes. So these children, they've had a stroke, they've had a brain injury, there's been an infarct, so that part of their brain is not functioning. So they are much like our adult patients. They do develop hemiplegia and difficulty with swallowing. So before they're even discharged, they do a swallow test. We automatically pull in rehab, so PTOT. We bring in the pediatric psychologist. That's what Dr. Maria Korth is. I may be misstating her proper title, but she comes in and evaluates them for growth and development, where they're at, talks to the family where they were before, and then comes up with a plan. These children are in lifelong rehab, PT, OT, speech therapies, because they will all need IEPs when they go to school. They will all need assistance. And because each stage of the growth and development, for normal growth and development, we learn new things, right? So essentially, they may look like they're doing great at 12 months, okay? But then you take them to walk and you find out they can't walk. They need ankle supports, they need walkers, they need special shoes. So you have to take that into effect. And then if they don't use part of their hand and they ignored that part of their body, you do restrictive therapy where you actually take the good hand and arm and hold it against their body and force them to use with their left hand that's not functioning. They have vision changes. They have personality changes, behavior issues. They can go from being a sweet little loving child to a total terror, as some parents define. And then some of them become autistic. So they have psychosocial issues. Cognitively, as they develop, they'll do fine for a period of time, and then as arithmetic becomes more difficult, when they need to read more than 5 words in a row, when they need to remember what they have read, those abilities show up that they are unable to do so. So they need special needs and support in those areas too. I found an article that I thought was interesting. For the first year after a child has a stroke, the average out-of-pocket costs for care is approximately $46,000. When the child is 5, you take that times 15, and that's the approximate cost that families have with these children in maintaining all these specialties, clinics that they are needing to survive and grow and develop. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, very much so. This is something that I had hardly any knowledge about. So thank you so much. I was just kind of also wanting to know if there is any like one tidbit of information or knowledge that you can share with primary care providers, ENT providers like Toby and I, because I keep thinking about the patient population that we see and I'm like, oh my goodness, like our patients with dysphagia could have a stroke. What is one piece of information that you could share with us to help improve our care management and to acknowledge these patients?
Being aware that children do have strokes. Just be aware and have it always on your radar, especially if you have children coming into your clinic and the parents are reporting a change in behavior, a change in speech, not using a limb or a part of their body as well as the other. Always have it in the back of your mind. It's there and it's rare, but it can be a possibility of a previous stroke at some point.
Rebecca, can you talk about the education that you've created for families of kids who have had a stroke?
I developed a pediatric stroke patient education notebook for families, and I worked with the social worker that's on our team, and we hand that out to each family, and in it include all the steps that it takes to have a child with stroke. And one of the key components is the growth and development baby to age 18 that parents really hone in on. And it encourages them to stay within these supportive therapies so their child can grow and develop to the best possible life they can possibly have. And it contains resources like the Mid-American Stroke Association for pediatric patients, which is a great resource for them to reach out to so they don't feel so isolated that they're the only ones that have a child that has had a stroke and how to live with it and move forward. So that has been a big piece of this process of providing education, not only to my peers, to other providers, to other hospitals, but also to families.
Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing all of that information with us. We like to end each episode with the same question. So we want to know, what is the most sensible or useful piece of advice you have heard lately? And it can apply to your job or just life, but just something that's sort of spoken to you lately.
It's a phrase: let the success of others encourage you, not discourage your goals.
I like that one.
I do too. That's a good one. Well,
thank you.
Yeah. You know, Rebecca, you are a wealth of knowledge. So thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a true pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed being here.
Thanks for listening in today. If you have a topic you would like to hear about or you're interested in being a guest, you can email us at tdobrien@cmh.edu or twilliams@cmh.edu. Once again, thanks so much for listening to the Advanced Practice Perspectives podcast.